Hi, welcome to Money Matters TV. I am Patty Tuadros. I'm your host and also own Zercel. And my co-host today is Paul Mitchell, who's a longtime commercial banker.
Thanks, Patty.
Nice
good to see you.
Nice to see you today. So I know the topic we might talk about today, the whole show, when our guest later from Obermeyer is going to be about selling and buying a business.
Lots of questions about that, whether it's larger businesses or big businesses. I mean, most of the businesses that you and I deal with or would be talking about, you're not going to read about in the Wall Street Journal, I don't think, or Barron's.
Not yet. When they're ready to sell, hopefully.
Right. But some of the concepts are still the same. I think the main difference is that the smaller businesses and the smaller the business, the more informal the business is and the more informal how they operate, et cetera. So it's a lot more between the lines, not just on the lines. So, I mean, you have professional businesses, for example, that frequently are dependent upon one or two or three people. And that's, how do you value that, for example, if somebody is selling and then going to be leaving?
Right, I know I just finished the Goldman Sachs program, and that's all about growing your business and how you're going to exit your business. And I started to think about it because of the show, being a guest and talking to different people, and it really changed my attitude that I'm not just going to roll through the next 15 years being a service provider, a consultant to people, but figure out how to turn it into a recurring revenue model.
There you go. Sure.
Where I can sell. There's value without me because I'm not selling somebody a job.
Right. So if you left it, there's still contracts or obligations or people are dependent upon the services of your company to continue providing whatever they need to have done.
I found that for the last 15 years I've traded on my own personal name that people are buying because they're buying from Patty. But
that's
I
right.
found that that's you can't grow a business when that's how you're selling.
Right.
People have to buy for your company, not a specific employee.
Yeah. But you know, even with larger businesses, I'm talking about still relatively small businesses, I'll define a small business as maybe under $10 million in revenues. Mm-hmm. If you're in New York City, that would be an infinitesimal small business. But for our discussions, let's say under $10 million, frequently the owner, founder, is still very much the company. He makes all the decisions. He doesn't delegate authority very much. He has all the relationships with the major customers. So if he were gone, there goes your relationship. I mean, maybe the new owner could reestablish or whatever, but still, one thing you know is gone, that well-established relationship, and now that customer is going to be maybe looking around or something like that.
I know, tend to be from my experience that when people sell in this sort of space where it's consulting and not a product, that you end up having to stay with the buyer for a few years.
Sure, for that very reason. Absolutely.
Seamless transition.
Sure, and sometimes very frequently in small business, and I would highly recommend it to any buyer to try to negotiate it anyway, is not paying all the money up front. For that very reason. So let's say it's a $10 million revenues business, and let's say it somebody's buying it for $1 million. Mm-hmm. Well, how do you know it's going to still be a $10 million business in 2 years if the owner is gone and not active, not maintaining the relationships?
How do you sell a $10 million business for $1 million? Shouldn't it be more like you're selling it for $100 million? Or $30 million?
Well, if you want to jump there, I'll go into that a little bit.
Let's
typically,
it's help me fantasize about
okay.
my exit.
Well, the buyer has to justify it. So let's say they paid $10 million for your $10 million business. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, does your $10 million business make $100,000 a year profit? Does it make $1 million a year profit? Does it make $2 million a year profit? Does it make $5 million a year profit? There's what's going to determine the value. So number one, you have to see what the profit is or the cash flow that it generates on a reasonable basis. And I'll get into that in a second. And number two, depending upon the growth of the company and the industry, well, the multiple that somebody might pay for that $1 million profit might be 3 times the $1 million, 4 times, 5, maybe 10. The more profitable business it is, the greater the multiple probably, okay? Because if you have a $10 million revenues and you're making a $7 million profit, that's a pretty attractive business. You know, you're not digging ditches, I'll tell you that. okay, or selling fuel oil with a 3% profit margin.
Right.
So it all depends. And then, of course, you get into the whole thing of the quality of the financial statements. If you, the owner, let's say your business has $1 million in revenues.
Okay.
And let's say you pay yourself $500,000 a year.
I like the story.
$500,000 a year. And you leave $5,000 left in the business as a profit. Did the business make a $5,000 profit? Did it make a $505,000 profit?
Well, they talk about putbacks, right?
Or did it make something in between? Exactly, right. Exactly. So people will sort of
finagle it,
put salt and pepper and that type of thing and say, well, maybe if we had a paid professional manager, we'd be paying them $170,000. Mm-hmm. So there are all ways of looking at it.
Right.
Tricky.
And the other thing we talked a lot in my class about is, as business owners, so often you try and make it look like you make no money.
So you don't
deduct everything.
So you don't pay taxes.
Right. And now when you go to sell it, it has no profit and nobody wants it. It's such a fine line.
Can't have it both ways, can you?
No. So if you're thinking about selling, you got to start paying the taxes, right?
Well, that's part of it. The main part, though, is it's be the appropriate time early on for your planning purposes to contact some excellent advisors. Find out what other entrepreneurs have used in the past for similar circumstances or other professionals in the buying and selling of businesses, whether it's bankers or other lawyers or investment bankers. Contact, so get a good accountant, mm-hmm. Get a top-notch attorney that you can develop a relationship with and discuss these things with, and structure for the future and plan. And other advisors, like I said, investment bankers would love to represent your firm for sale. If and when it's going to be for sale in a few years, develop a relationship with them now.
That's a good idea.
See if you like them. See if you like working with them.
I know I've been writing down names over the last few years from the people who have been on the show.
There you go.
And now we get a new one today, which I'm excited to to hear the whole story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Probably pay. And I think it pays for these people to have a little gray hair. I've seen a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you can have a Harvard MBA and be 32 years old, but if you haven't seen this happen 500 or 600 times through different cycles, ups and downs and all, I mean, you may want to sell your business next year, maybe the top of a cycle. Terrific. Go for it. Or you say that you wait 3 years and now you have a bottom of the cycle. Happened to lots of people. I know a guy that went to school with. He contacted me about 10 years ago, said he was selling his business. And he signed up some big Wall Street firm, that type of thing. This was like a small business, probably $20, $30 million in revenues, family business and that type of thing. Well, he had heard all the stories from his buddies at the country club and all the prices they got and the multiples and that type of thing. So he was holding on to the big bucks, the big price. Recession hit.
Oh, man.
10 years later, he's still running the business. And probably the business has probably, gone down a bit because of the recession. So it's not worth as much, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, hopefully he'll be able to exit soon.
I think so. He's going to be turning 70, so. Yeah. He'd probably like to.
Yeah. Definitely want to get to our guest because I'm sure a lot of people will be interested. So let me ask you a question from our viewer, Janet Gale in Philadelphia. When you're looking to buy a business, what are some signs that you should look for to not buy the business?
Exactly. That's an excellent question. I think we sort of touched upon that. Well, I would say the first thing would be the relationship you have with the seller. Is the seller willing to be transparent, give you full disclosure, give you full access to the information? It's a touchy thing because most sellers really don't want anybody else to know that the business is for sale. They don't want their employees to know. Mm-hmm. They don't want their competition to know. And they don't want their customers to know. They don't want anybody else to know. So the more they disclose to you, even with a confidentiality agreement, they're letting something out of the bag. And maybe somebody else will find out. So that's a tough balance there. But if the person says, I won't tell you anything, or you just get the feeling that they're not telling you everything, you've got a real problem. So that's a soft issue.
Trust your gut.
Trust your gut, absolutely. A hard issue would be the quality of their financial statements. Is it prepared by a qualified accountant? Doesn't have to be a certified public accountant, but a qualified accountant. Does it make sense? Show the numbers to your accounting expert. Does it make sense? Does it follow the rules?
How many years back do you think is realistic to ask for financials? 5 years, 10, 2?
Well, if as a banker, we typically require at least 3 years. Mm-hmm. If I were buying a business, I would want to go back 10 years. I want to see the trend. I want to see the ups and downs. Now, if they say they don't have financial statements, well, they have one other thing they have. They file tax returns. Right. And banks like to look at tax returns, too, because they'll compare the tax returns to the financial statements to see if it makes sense. I mean, obviously, there's going to be differences in the presentation and all, right, but it's got to still kind of work together.
Okay, good.
So those are two things definitely to look for.
All right, that's good advice. Now, I'm sure that you have questions, and if you want to send them into Money Matters, here's how to do it.
You can have your questions answered on Money Matters. Please go to our website, money-matterstv.com. On our homepage, click on the banner on the right that says, Send Us Your Questions. While you're on our website, you can find information about our host and guests, as well as show notes and links about this show and past shows. Money Matters is also available as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen to Money Matters while you're on the go. That website address, again, is money, M-O-N-E-Y, dash matters, M-A-T-T-E-R-S-T-V.com.
Hi, now I want to welcome Dominic Liberi from Obermeyer, Redmond, Maxwell, and Hipple. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I know this is a hot topic, obviously, for me. I'm super interested in the ins and outs of selling a business and buying a business.
And me too. And we have our different angles too.
Yeah, from banking and from entrepreneurial.
Right. So we don't have an accounting background, right, and we certainly don't have a legal perspective.
Well, the interesting thing about being in the legal business, as it were, is you have an opportunity to interact with entrepreneurs, accountants, bankers. Mm-hmm. And you begin to see the landscape more like in a 360 perspective. It's the beauty, I think, of my profession is we sort of have to get down into the weeds and have to, mm-hmm, see what's going on in every deal. And so the opportunity to interact, I would say, somewhat intensely with other professionals and, of course, the seller, mm-hmm, if you're representing the seller, if you're fortunate enough to represent the seller for business or the buyer, as it were. You really have to have a good sense of what's happening there, especially if it's not a long-term relationship. Oftentimes, attorneys receive recommendations from bankers, accountants, to represent entrepreneurs who, shall we say, had a lawyer that was helpful in terms of their real estate lease, mm-hmm, or their basic contracts, but a little bit above the pay grade when it gets down to time to selling the business, mm-hmm, and they need sort of a higher level of expertise. So I'm often introduced, and in that context, mm-hmm, have to really learn not only the personality of the seller,
yeah, sure,
and their organization, but the inner workings of the organization. I have to really go behind the curtain.
Yeah, it's a combination as we were discussing, of soft issues and, yeah, very hard issues.
And the tricky ones, yes.
Sure, sure.
Exactly.
So tell us a little about your background and experience.
I've represented just about every kind of entrepreneur you can imagine. I've also, okay, continue to represent some public companies, mm-hmm, but my primary focus, I would say, is entrepreneurs. And, mm-hmm, it's really the pleasure of my practice is working with a business person, either from the startup phase through the sale, or really just to be involved in an acquisition of a business. That's exciting, and helping someone exit their business successfully, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
I had one client, after he sold the business, we had the closing, he came into the office with a photographer, he had his professionals around the table, we were all taking pictures together. We had to autograph, uh-huh, a certain thing. So it was really a celebration,
yeah,
for him of,
sure,
the closing. And he memorialized it.
That's, yeah, fantastic.
It was very unusual.
Party, party, party.
It was very extraordinary. We have to come in. We're going to take a photo together, uh-huh, and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun. I mean, it's really, yeah, the joy of the business, if you will, the profession, mm-hmm, is to help people. That's really why I'm a lawyer,
yeah,
in the first place. And so helping someone exit successfully, mm-hmm, to me, that's really a good day's work.
How do you know when to start, for myself, when I should sell my business?
Well, most people, you say, well, you should really start at the time of the business plan before you even open the doors to contemplate, when am I getting out of this business? What's my plan? What's my long-range goal here? Of course, most people don't. You know, they're thinking more about, how do I make this business a success,
right,
not when do I exit it?
Yeah.
So in that context, it's kind of difficult to know, you know, what's the optimal time. But I think there are several things that come into play. I think one thing, at least that I've seen in my experience, business owners at a certain point in time, they say, I've really had enough, my business is successful. Or in the case of a family business or an employee succession plan where key employees are going to be assuming the ownership, in that situation, the timing is right, the owner knows it. So I think it varies with the business, it varies with the individual, but sometimes it's a forced decision because an offer comes along you never expected, mm-hmm. and it's too good to pass up.
Sure, like the Middleton Cigar Company.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know that story. What happened?
Well, John Middleton is one of the main owners of the Philadelphia Phillies, and his family had a long-time, 100-year-old cigar manufacturing company in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay. And it wasn't like Cuban cigars, it was like everyday cigars, but you know, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues or something like that.
Wow.
So about 10 years ago, roughly, I guess, one of the big cigarette companies that was, you know, being forced to all kinds of, you know, fines and, you know, the cigarette business was sliding and that type of thing, made him some astronomical offer for like $2 billion, something of that nature.
Wow.
So way out, this is the surprise offer. Couldn't say no.
How fast can he get to closing, right?
Exactly.
before they look too closely.
Exactly what happens. So there's that, you know, there's that situation. Then there's market-driven situations where the market's just up for the company's had 3, 4, 5 years of great revenue growth, strong bottom line growth, and the owner feels like, you know, if I don't do it now, what may happen, such as the example of a business owner that holds on for too long,
right.
The market slips, or a competitor eclipses them, whatever may happen. So the timing is delicate, and it almost requires a sixth sense in a business owner. You know, this is the time. I really, you know, I've been approached recently by a client who said to me, you know, I've been in this business for quite a while. I'm ready to make a move. He said, I'm ready to sell. So my first question was, how can I help you?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I'm setting out to do. So I think there are, you know, there are just circumstances that you have to be alert and be sensitive to, you know, your own timing and how you feel about what you're doing. Sometimes you can exit in different ways. I mean, you can bring in a partner and build up the organization that way and then pass it off to the partner as an mm-hmm. You know, can have a sort of a predetermined exit strategy with the partner.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, my business is at this level. I need a few more years. You come in and join me. We join forces at X dollars. You buy me out. We fix the price ahead of time or the multiple,
mm-hmm.
and we're good to go. So there are a lot of ways to make the end result come into existence.
So let me ask you. Let's say I do eventually want to sell my business, and I am changing my model to make it more valuable, but at what point do I come to you and say, Dominic, I have a plan, I maybe 5 years, maybe six, maybe two, I want to sell, and what are the steps?
Okay, well, so when someone comes to me with that, I would say, number one, begin to examine your company internally as far as its strengths and weaknesses and what you need to do to sort of build it up to the level that you wish it to obtain. Are you satisfied with, you know, for example, we mentioned accounting as a key oftentimes in business. Are you satisfied with your internal, you know, financial folks? Are you satisfied with your external folks to maximize your tax position, et cetera? And also to begin to position the company for sale, because you can have a profitable company, but yet there are issues inside that make it present risk in the way the taxes have been managed, in the way the finances have been managed. And those risks have to be dealt with, and there are ways of dealing with them to get them behind you, so to speak. I had one client who had a tax issue and worked closely with a particular accounting firm, and he addressed it by advising the client, you need to deal with this tax issue and you need to deal with it quickly. Here's a way of dealing with it. We can spread the tax liabilities out over 4 years, mm-hmm. and then they'll be behind you.
Yeah.
And so the partners agreed, and they were able to make an election and so forth. So that just have to address the circumstances at hand. Preparing to sell your company takes as much work almost as being successful in it sometimes. And then I think a broker is valuable to meet, many brokers, many investment bankers, just to get a sense of what are they thinking about my industry, what do they think, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you have an investment banker or can find one or be introduced to one who has worked in your space, all the better. I mean, that's like a value-added proposition because they know your industry, they've sold companies in your industry.
Yeah, they know the players in the industry who might buy.
They know buyers.
For
that's another aspect. They can help introduce you to the right
that's
buyer.
That's it. Yeah. How do you find the buyer? You can have this great, amazing company, but don't even know who to sell it to.
Well, you know, you attend industry functions. You interact with others and peers, others in your industry, and so you begin to dialogue about that with them and what are their thoughts and begin to internalize that, but also identifying investment bankers. And with the internet now, the beauty of the internet is there's nothing you can't really learn if you really work at it, and you can find investment bankers.
But if you believe it,
well, yeah, I mean, then you then
there's the danger. So the face to face, the one on one, who they are, who are they really is very important.
Well, then I would call you or Dominic,
right.
I would say, so
let's talk about these people.
Well, I would suggest one of your best avenues would be a larger
competitor,
somebody in your space that's, let's say, eight times your size.
Squarespace, I'd love
to sell to them. They want to buy 10 of you guys.
Right.
That's their strategy. So it fits in their strategy.
Yeah, but how do you get them to pay attention to you?
I would do it through an intermediary that doesn't disclose who you are.
Yeah, and if the word gets out, let's say I go to networking events and I tell people, yeah, I'm thinking about selling, I'm not going to get clients.
There's a
people
problem
are
going to
think
that.
you're checked out.
You've got to do it through an intermediary.
Yeah. But right now, I'm fully committed to my business.
Good. That's what we like to hear.
Yeah, of course.
The time will come, and preparing for that day is, I mean, you're very wise. It's a sage idea. Start thinking about it now. Start planning for it strategically.
Here's my other piece of advice. I always ask people, give me a model of something similar to you 3 to 5 years earlier. So find a business similar to yours. Mm-hmm. They sold their business 3 to 5 years ago. Okay? What was their, how did they work it? Okay? And what does it look like now? Okay? That is, did they get all cash up front? Probably not. You know, did it work out in the long run? What were some of the pitfalls? What were some of the positive things?
Is that still public?
No, it's individual. You're on, you're in the industry. You should know.
What the sale price was and how the deal was closed.
Generally not. None of it's
private
business.
So you have to ask a friend.
That's right. Well, this is
You'll get very, you don't know what to believe. I sold my business for $1 million. I always follow up, how much did you get for cash? None of your business.
I thought it was all cash. What are you talking about not getting it all up front? If I sell you my business and I'm leaving, I'll give you a year to transition relationships.
I'll give you 30% up front and we'll see how the rest works out over the next 3 years.
Meanwhile, you've agreed to give away your business, but you have no commitment to.
Well, you have to build in some protections from a legal perspective.
That's why you need an amazing attorney,
exactly.
Right?
DIY. There's backstopping on that.
There's no legal
prohibitions on certain things occurring without your permission.
Money goes in escrow.
The payment stream has to be somewhat guaranteed by someone. And generally speaking, you really don't want to have a deal that's financed by the seller. That's why they made banks. Okay. You go to the bank, you borrow the money, you buy the company. That's typically how it works.
The seller doesn't want to, but the buyer does. And whoever's financing it also wants to have those contingencies.
Right. They don't want to get left holding
You want some backstop protection if you're a buyer.
So there's your homework to get involved and find out more about a bunch of transactions like that. You know, say that you want to find out about 10 transactions that happen in the next 5 years, in the last 5 years in your industry.
And they can be in ancillary industries. They don't have to be identical industries, too, just to be.
I'm watching this company grow, Squarespace, which is way ahead. That's a dream of a goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was telling Paul earlier, they get about 1,000 new customers, I think it's a week, maybe it's a month. And these people are paying anywhere from $9 a month to $25 a month.
They have a model.
They've raised so much money. It's insane to me how much money.
They have a model.
Yeah.
And they're working it through the web. Obviously, the internet's the
Silicon Valley and go to a few networking events for
a couple
of months. And do surfing in between. Sure.
Absolutely.
So how can you make your business more sellable?
Well, I think there's several things. I believe the first thing that I've seen a lot of successful business people over the years. And one famous entrepreneur that I knew had a plaque on his wall that said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. So if you have an end game in mind, if you have a goal in mind, that certainly helps a lot to get your company in a position, because you're going to say, if I want my company to sell, I need to focus on that aspect that if I were buying it, what would I be looking for?
Right.
If I were kicking the tires, how would I feel about this or about that? And I found that the best companies are those that are run so well that they can run themselves without the owner. They're, everything they're documented on procedures, on policies, on emergencies, on crisis management. Companies where it's necessary for everyone to consult with everybody on everything
and other,
tend to be in drag.
And other managers know the customers.
See, right.
The business that the owner has that intimate relationship on the golf course and that type of thing, and nobody else really has that relationship.
Yeah, the personality-driven company is difficult you know? To sell
that's,
sometimes.
That's where I am now that I'm trying to move away from.
Sometimes that is.
Yeah.
Now, relationships are key in the service, as we know.
But I guess if you bring them in and then you bring them into your team and you step away, then it's not so much about the owner anymore. It becomes about the customer service and the product.
It always is about that anyway. It's always about delivering value.
Yeah.
Whether you're doing it, or whether you're on the point, or whether you're having others in your organization do it. And to the extent that your folks in your organization can pick up the ball and run with it, that actually is impressive to your customer base. It's like, wow, your company is well run.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with a sole practitioner, because if they catch a cold or get run over by a car, I'm a dead man.
You're worried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we only have a few minutes left.
Okay.
Tell me the biggest pitfall you've ever seen.
Well, I have a sort of a pet peeve, and I recommend that companies that don't have inside counsel engage a law firm and an accounting firm to do a legal audit and a tax audit. Because I see a lot of deals, or have seen a lot of deals, crumble, break apart over small things that could have been prevented. A small, you know, a piece of intellectual property, a patent that hasn't been properly assigned, where the owner hasn't basically turned over their rights of the patent, even though they're long out of the company. Little things, I mean, you'd say, well, geez, it's just a signature on a piece of paper. But when you're on the threshold of closing, issues can arise, which if a year in advance, 2 years in advance, even 6 months in advance, you bring in a good accounting firm and a good law firm to do a legal audit, to check your contracts, your employment practices, your potential exposure and liabilities, your potential tax exposures and liabilities. If you do that kind of sort of pre-planning as far as issues that may arise, you will save a lot of aggravation, and you will avoid a lot of the pitfalls that will occur in the heat of the battle. Because once you sign a letter of intent with a potential buyer, and you begin exchanging due diligence, and you really start to get into the contract and negotiating the terms, things that come up in the course of the transaction, you can't imagine some of the things I've seen. And trying to put out those fires and get those ends and tied together prior to closing, becomes a fire drill.
It gives them leverage to lower the price.
And it gives them leverage. It pushes out closing dates. I mean, it really becomes stressful. The indemnities become greater. There's a lot of problems around that. So proper planning, a good pre-audit, if you will, pre-sale audit, I think can save a lot of aggravation. I try to persuade clients to do this, and I think it's just a valuable exercise for them to do.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
It was a great pleasure.
I know
enjoyed
I'll be calling you one day soon, I hope.
That would be my honor and pleasure as well.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you both.
Thank you. And we hope that you guys will join us again soon. Our next guest is Dale Power from Big Shoes, which is a marketing firm. And we look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.